will move this to the floor for a vote. He has to. The Republicans, quite frankly, are just lying again and again and again and not really doing their job.
Ben Jealous, I want to thank you for being with us, president of People for the American Way, former president of the NAACP. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Aaron Dooley. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Firth, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karanani, Masood, Adriano Contreras, and general managers Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Belka Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Governor Kate Brown says masks are no longer necessary inside or out for those fully vaccinated. The Portland City Council has approved a $5.7 billion budget for the next fiscal year. And the director of the Office of Community and Civic Life has resigned amid accusations that she created a culture of fear. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 14th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. Yesterday, Governor Kate Brown announced that fully vaccinated Oregonians no longer need face masks in most public settings. The governor's statement mirrored the position taken earlier in the day by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In a statement, Brown spokesperson Charles Boyle said, quote, "Going forward, fully vaccinated individuals in Oregon will generally not have to wear masks or practice physical distancing indoors or outdoors. Under the new rules, masks are still required in hospitals, clinics, and long-term care facilities, as well as jails and prisons. In addition, masks are still mandated on public transportation such as buses, trains, and planes, as well as at the airport." This statement was short on specifics, and Boyle went on to say, quote, "There are a number of complex policy and legal questions that need to be addressed in updating our current regulatory framework to reflect this new CDC guidance while ensuring the safety of both vaccinated and unvaccinated Oregonians." He said that the guidelines will be updated by the Oregon Health Authority in the coming days, but the authority was unable to provide a precise timeline for the update. Speculation is that the rule change will also cover retailers, restaurants, and other workplaces as long as the vaccination of employees and customers can be confirmed. And in an effort to improve declining inoculation rates, Governor Brown said, quote, "Oregonians now have a choice of how to protect themselves and others from COVID-19. Either get vaccinated or continue wearing a mask and following physical distancing requirements. Brown has previously stated that she plans to lift most pandemic restrictions once at least 70% of the state's 16 and older population is at least partially vaccinated. To date, over 1.5 million Oregonians have been fully vaccinated, and another 500,000 are in the process. Hopes are that the 70% threshold can be achieved sometime in June. The governor's mask announcement came the same day that the OHA reported an additional 733 new COVID-19 cases and 14 deaths. Yesterday, the Portland City Council voted unanimously to approve a $5.7 billion budget for the next fiscal year. The council will take a final vote on the budget in June. The city had been planning for a significant loss of revenue resulting from the pandemic, but an influx of federal money and additional funds from the newly enacted park levy allowed most bureaus to avoid significant budget cuts. Mayor Ted Wheeler said that the new budget aligns with priorities that the council established earlier this year, focusing on community safety, houselessness, and economic recovery from the pandemic. Budget highlights include $9.1 million for litter cleanup and graffiti removal, and $500,000 to cover the cost of repairs for small businesses that have been vandalized. There's also funding for minority chambers of commerce, relocation of the food carts displaced by the Ritz-Carlton downtown, services for trans people facing housing insecurity, and $20 per hour jobs for houseless folks to assist with cleanup. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty introduced an amendment to accelerate the scale-up of the Portland Street Response Program. She was supported by Commissioner Carmen Rubio, but Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners Mingus Mapps, and Dan Ryan voted to maintain its funding level of $1 million and to keep it in its current evaluation phase before attempting to scale up citywide. City bureaus and office will have $3.7 billion to spend in the next fiscal year, a reduction of about $100 million. The budget freezes cost of living adjustments and merit increases for many of the city's staff, while cutting a measly $3 million from the Portland Police Bureau's $228 million budget. $5.2 million was earmarked for the PPB to hire 30 new officers as well as 22 new community safety officers. The unarmed officers will respond to low-priority calls. Commissioner Hardesty introduced an amendment prohibiting the Bureau from using that money for any other purposes than those new hires. She also introduced an amendment that requires them to develop an evaluation program for community service officers. Both amendments passed. Yesterday, the Oregon House passed a bill that bans the LGBTQ+ panic defense. House Bill 704 states that, quote, discovery of a victim's actual or perceived gender, gender identity, gender expression, or sexual orientation does not constitute reasonable explanation for extreme emotional disturbance for purposes of affirmative defense to murder in the second degree. The defense has been used by defendants who claim diminished capacity because of their alleged fear or disgust over another's sexual orientation or gender identity. The legislation was co-sponsored by 10 senators and representatives and pushed by the advocacy group Basic Rights Oregon. A spokesperson for the group said that the new law will, quote, make it clear in statute and across Oregon that violent acts are not justified because of a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. Last year, the American Bar Association called for a ban on the gay panic defense nationwide. The bill now goes to Governor Brown to be signed into law, making Oregon the 14th state to prohibit the defense. Yesterday, the director of City Office of Community and Civic Life announced her resignation effective today. The announcement was made jointly by Director Sue Cree and Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, who has overseen the Bureau since January. Ree became the Bureau's director in 2017, but Willamette Week last summer reported that an exceptionally large number of complaints had been received by employees of the Bureau. At the time, City Ombudsman Margie Solinger stated that, quote, "the concerns we heard are well beyond ordinary workplace tribulations." The complaints prompted an independent audit by the Aceta consulting firm, but the city attorney's office claimed attorney-client privilege and refused public records requests from a number of local news organizations. But on Tuesday, Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt said the city had not proven its claim and ordered that the report be released. In March, Commissioner Hardesty told OPB that she had, quote, "never experienced a workplace that was so hostile to employees." Hardesty did not mention the report or the Bureau's problems in her joint statement with Ree, but in an email to Bureau employees, she said, quote, "I look forward to working with all of you to continue to co-create a Bureau that has alignment with its mission as well as improving workplace culture." The Bureau oversees Portland's 95 neighborhood associations and is responsible for a broad and seemingly disconnected range of city programs, including graffiti removal, assistance to those facing deportation, and cannabis sales. On Wednesday, the Federal Communications Commission introduced an emergency discount to help millions of low-income Americans pay for high-speed internet service. The FCC's subsidy program provides $50 per month discounts in an effort to support families that have struggled during the pandemic as schools, jobs, and services have moved online. The discounts are available for households on SNAP or Medicaid, recipients of Pell Grants, and families with children on free and reduced price lunch plans. Low-income households on tribal lands can qualify for $75 per month in subsidies, and all applicants are eligible for a one-time subsidy of $100 towards a laptop or tablet computer. 825 broadband providers nationwide have agreed to offer the discounts. $3.2 billion has been allocated for the program, which was approved by Congress late last year, after lengthy delays in discussions between the FCC and the Trump administration. The program is currently scheduled to end when either the fund is depleted or 6 months after the Department of Health and Human Services declares an end to the pandemic, but there is hope for an extension. President Biden has promised to make broadband affordable and available for all, and has proposed a $100 billion effort to connect every rural and low-income home to high-speed internet service. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Tonight, it will be clear with overnight temperatures dipping into the low 50s. And tomorrow, we can expect a sunny, warm day with a high of 80. On this day in 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark left St. Louis with 45 men to explore the Northwest. Today there are two quotes. The first is from Nez Perce Chief Joseph, who said, quote, "The first white men of your people who came to our country were named Lewis and Clark. They brought many things that our people had never seen. They talked straight. These men were very kind." The second is from historian William Least Heat Moon, who said, quote, "The negative cost of Lewis and Clark entering the Garden of Eden is that, regardless of what they were intended to do, later expeditions did not deal with the native peoples with the intelligence and with the almost kindly resolve that Lewis and Clark did." The Environmental Protection Agency has awarded the Confederated Tribes of Grande Ronde $800,000 to restore the Willamette Falls. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. In Oregon, a federal grant will help the Confederated Tribes of Grande Ronde restore the Willamette Falls. Oregon Public Broadcasting reported the Environmental Protection Agency awarded $800,000 to the tribes this week to help them identify and test for hazardous substances at the site, which formerly houses a paper mill. The waterfall is the second largest by volume in the country. The Grande Ronde bought the site in 2019. The land was ceded to the U.S. government under a treaty in 1855, and tribal members were forcibly removed from the Willamette Falls. The Grande Ronde have been working on a plan to restore the land and provide public access. They also are working on a plan for mixed-use development in the area that may include housing, commercial spaces, and educational sites about the tribe's history in the area. The president of the Haskell Indian Nations University in Kansas was removed late last week by the Bureau of Indian Education. Native News Online reports the move came after an investigation revealed Dr. Ronald Graham was stifling the free speech rights of students and faculty. The Faculty Senate of Haskell delivered a vote of no confidence last month in Graham, according to the student newspaper, The Indian Leader. Graham had blocked the paper's editor from routine news reporting, and the administration reduced its budget after refusing to recognize the paper as a student organization. In the no confidence vote, Graham was criticized for failing to call a required Board of Regents meeting during his first year in office. Faculty Senate members said that threatened Haskell's Higher Learning Commission accreditation. Graham began as president on May 15, 2020. Dr. Tamara Pfeiffer, who is Diné, will assume the role of acting president. She is the chief academic officer with the Bureau of Indian Education and has a long career as a teacher and administrator. A young Oglala Lakota and Han Gwich'in woman who calls herself a climate warrior and land protector is on the cover of Vogue Mexico this month, sporting high fashion and her own indigenous jewelry. Native News Online reports Quanah Chasing Horse is featured in a 20-page spread in the magazine. In 2019, Chasing Horse and her sister called on leaders at the Alaska Federation of Natives Conference to declare a state of emergency on climate change and reinstate a task force to push for stronger climate policies. Chasing Horse says her goal is to be more than a model, but also a role model. She told Native News Online, quote, to see good representation through beauty and fashion will change people's minds and thoughts. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
The CDC has announced that fully vaccinated people can move about freely without masks. With more on the story and others, here's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Today is a great day for America.
President Joe Biden celebrated the CDC's announcement that fully vaccinated Americans can go without masks indoors and outdoors. But CDC Director Rochelle Walensky cautioned that unvaccinated people are still at risk.
If you are not fully vaccinated, you are not fully protected, and so you need to be continuing to wear your mask.
Masks will still be required in healthcare settings and on public transportation. Biden also encouraged patients dealing with East Coast gas shortages caused by a cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline.
I know seeing lines at the pumps or gas stations with no gas can be extremely stressful, but this is a temporary situation.
The president urged consumers don't buy more gas than needed and warned stations against price gouging. The gas supply is expected to improve this weekend. Meanwhile, Biden said he still wants a bipartisan compromise on infrastructure, and he said he's optimistic after a White House meeting with GOP senators. Republicans have put forward a much smaller proposal than Biden's $2.3 trillion plan. Republicans are also pushing for the end of additional federal unemployment benefits. Georgia joined more than a dozen other states opting out of the $300 payments. Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville argues there's a growing shortage of workers.
I go to Alabama and I usually go back and get patted on the back. I'm getting chewed out now because we're up here giving money out. We don't need to be giving money out. We need to go back to work. We need to go back to school.
Currently, the payments are planned through September, and supporters argue they're still needed while there are more unemployed folks than open jobs. Immigration was front and center in Congress, with each party blaming the other for the rise of migrants at the southern border. In the Senate, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas defended the administration's policies.
We're the United States of America. 90% of these children have a parent or legal guardian in the United States, and they have a claim of fear of persecution.
Last month, the U.S. held nearly 14,000 unaccompanied minors in custody, about 9% fewer than in March. In a House hearing, Customs Enforcement Director Tay Johnson asked for more assistance to respond to the humanitarian crisis.
In some locations, the processing of families have strained our resources. This cannot be sustained unless we receive sufficient funding to keep these families safe after they cross the border.
There were nearly 180,000 arrests and detentions at the border in April, one of the highest one-month totals in two decades. The House Ways and Means Committee talked trade yesterday. U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai said the administration is reviewing tariffs on Chinese imports.
We will not hesitate to call out China's coercive and unfair trade practices that harm American workers, undermine the multilateral system, or violate basic human rights.
Tai also noted concerns from drug companies over U.S. moves to waive intellectual property rights on COVID-19 vaccines. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
A group of attorneys general in Tennessee have signed a letter opposing the launch of a proposed Instagram for children. They're concerned that it's detrimental to the development of the target audience, children under 13. For more on the story, here's Nadia Ramlagan with the Public News Service.
Tennessee's attorney general is part of a group that wants Facebook to stop its plans to create a kids' version of Instagram. The group contends using social media can be detrimental to children's health and well-being, and that kids aren't equipped to navigate the challenges. Tennessee AG Herbert Slattery signed the letter along with more than 40 other state attorneys general. Facebook has said it wouldn't show ads on the Instagram platform for kids under 13. But Tennessee Chief Deputy Attorney General Jonathan Scrimetti says, ads or no ads, the platform will be designed to acclimate kids to social media at a time when they're psychologically vulnerable.
And so they're creating consumers, and they're creating consumers who don't recognize that they're going to essentially be commodified by these companies going forward.
Earlier this year, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg confirmed plans for an Instagram for kids during a congressional hearing on misinformation. In a statement, a Facebook spokesperson said the company wants to deliver experiences for kids that give parents visibility and control over what their children are doing. Scrimetti sees the possibility of litigation down the road related to this issue and points to Facebook's record of failing to protect kids' safety and privacy on its platform.
I think the goal was to avoid the need for litigation by appealing to the better angels of Facebook's nature and hoping that they recognize that there is severe harm that could happen if they start targeting children with their product.
Reports from 2019 showed Facebook's Messenger Kids app, intended for kids between ages 6 and 12, contained a major design flaw that allowed children to join group chats with strangers, not approved by their parents.
There are a lot of benefits that come from technology, but there are a lot of risks involved, and those risks are magnified for children. And we're going to do everything we can to use the law to protect children, but parents need to be aware of what's going on.
A report for the National Council for Missing and Exploited Children found in 2020 more than 20 million images related to child abuse had been shared on Facebook and Instagram. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Claiming that the extra benefits are keeping people from returning to work, Idaho Governor Brad Little is planning to pull the state out of the federal program that provides enhanced unemployment benefits during the pandemic. Many are concerned that a return to work means that many low-wage workers will continue to fall behind. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff.
Governor Brad Little announced this week he will pull Idaho out of the federal unemployment programs that have provided enhanced benefits to people who lost jobs during the pandemic. Little says employers are struggling to find workers because some are making more money on unemployment, citing a federal program that adds $300 a week. But Kirsten Pocup with the Idaho Center for Fiscal Policy says the move could have unintended consequences, as many Idaho families continue to struggle with low wages and rising housing costs.
We also have an additional problem, which is somewhat unique to Idaho, in that we have a child care shortage. And so there's really a lack of spots for families to put their children under the age of 6. So that also impacts how easy it is for people to go back to work.
Idaho will end its participation on June 19th in federal unemployment programs that increase compensation and extend benefits past the regular time limit for unemployment and to folks who usually don't qualify. Chambers of commerce across the state have praised Little's decision. Pocup says even though more people are going back to work, about 93,000 Idahoans reported their households didn't have enough to eat in March. She says it's more proof of costs rising in the state, despite Idaho's minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, the same as the federal minimum.
For these very low-paid jobs, families have to consider, what's my health worth? And if they're only going to be paid a very low wage and they have a really high risk of catching the virus, they have a really difficult calculus to make.
There have been about 190,000 COVID-19 cases and 2,000 deaths in Idaho. More than 540,000, or nearly 39% of Idahoans age 16 and older, are fully vaccinated. Pocup says the state can help workers in a few ways, such as investing more money in child care and creating more affordable housing.
There's federal money available to support low-income housing and to build more housing units. We need more of that to help with the supply, which will ultimately help with the cost of living to help make Idaho more affordable.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Citing their importance in a balanced ecosystem, scientists are asking the Biden administration to reinstate protection for gray wolves. The protections were removed by the Trump administration before leaving office. For more on the story, here's Roz Brown with the Public News Service.
With a new administration at the White House, a group of scientists is asking that federal protections be reinstated for gray wolves under the Endangered Species Act. In a letter sent Thursday, 115 scientists with expertise in areas related to wolf conservation are asking Interior Secretary Deb Haaland and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to restore protections eliminated in January by the Trump administration. Colette Adkins with the Center for Biological Diversity says the current designation cannot sustain wolf populations.
Wolves are so important to our ecosystems, and there's so many places where wolves once lived and could live again.
The letter argues that gray wolves do not currently meet the principle of representation because they do not securely inhabit the West Coast, Southern Rockies, the Great Plains, or the Northeast, vast regions of the country where they once flourished. Adkins says scientists who signed the letter want the federal government to get involved because they don't believe states can be trusted with wolf management. One example, she says, is a recent wolf hunt in Wisconsin that lasted past its quota.
We just saw outrageous legislation passed in Idaho and Montana that would extirpate wolves there, basically driving them down to the brink of extinction again, removing more than 90% of the animals in the state.
Adkins adds that the recent legislation of wolf management in states like Idaho and Montana puts long-term recovery of wolves in jeopardy by reducing the probability of dispersals from existing recovery areas. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Rising sea levels are claiming parts of North Carolina's Outer Banks and taking pieces of history with them. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Portsmouth Village, on an island off the coast of North Carolina, was once a thriving shipping town. Today, nobody lives there, but buildings such as a wooden church, a post office, a school, and clapboard houses remain, and they offer a glimpse into life more than a century ago. But as the climate changes, rising seas and more extreme storms threaten to destroy these historic landmarks. In 2019,
Hurricane Dorian was absolutely devastating. Every single historic structure in Portsmouth Village was damaged and heavily impacted by that storm.
That's Jeff West, superintendent of Cape Lookout National Seashore, which includes the island. He says that after the storm, the National Park Service demolished two buildings that would have been expensive to repair and highly vulnerable to future damage. He says it was a difficult decision.
You lose history. You lose a sense of where you've been and where you came from when this stuff disappears.
So the National Park Service aims to preserve as much of the historic village as possible for as long as is practical. But as waters rise and damaging waves crash ashore,
it gets harder all the time.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 14th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Ray Bodwell, Althea Billings, Megan Kamrick, Nadia Ramlagan, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our wonderful programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.